This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz, and Jim Russ is out on an assignment this week, so I'm going to be having to handle this show solo, but I think we can get through it. It's been an interesting week in technology. For one thing, there was a big hacking story that hit the news. H.B. Gary was hacked by Anonymous. And we will go through the rundown of exactly what they did, how they did it. There was an interview with Ars Technica that interviewed Anonymous, and we'll see how they did it and what mistakes H.G. Gary made in configuring their system and managing their passwords. This last week, for those of you that are interested in trivia of the week, we now have a new record on the number of digits in pi. So we'll talk about how they did that. It's not really that important, but it's really a nice thing to talk about because they used a new technique to do that. We're also going to discuss this week the man behind the largest instant messenger service in China, Pony Ma. His first name is Pony. His last name is Ma. We'll talk about where he got his name and what he's doing there. And we got a huge amount of mail in the mailbag today. So now it is time for the mail. We got an email from Robert Tyler. Now, Robert Tyler said, "Dear Dr. Schertz, I've been reading about the online attack from H.B. Gary by the hacktivist group Anonymous. Could you explain what H.B. Gary does and why H.B. Gary was the subject of the attack and how the hackers gained access?" Actually, this is why I looked into this, because Robert Tyler was curious about this. "Thanks for a great podcast. I look forward to it every week. Loyal Tech Talk podcast listener, Robert Tyler." Well, Robert, later in the show, I'm going to get into the details of how Anonymous hacked into H.B. Gary's site. There's a lot to be learned from that. And we'll run down, trying to not get too technical, but I think there is definitely some security lessons to be learned from it. But Anonymous is a loose-knit group of hackers, or called hacker activists. They call them hacktivists. And they're tied to a notorious message board for hackers, 4chan, 4CHAN. You can Google it up. And this group actually hits targets whenever they think they're not behaving to their liking. For instance, there were a number of people trying to bring down the WikiLeaks site. Some of the credit card companies withdrew support to WikiLeaks so they couldn't raise funds. Other companies were trying to locate how to shut down the WikiLeaks site. And the people on 4chan didn't like that. So they decided to attack the people who were trying to bring down WikiLeaks. And in particular, they did a number of distributed denial of service attacks against Visa and against MasterCard and other places. And actually, these distributed denial of service attacks are illegal. And so the federal government started looking into it. In particular, they had H.B. Gary looking at it. And H.B. Gary Company thinks they located and named and were about ready to name the people who were behind the Anonymous distributed denial of service attacks. And so the CEO of H.B. Gary felt he knew who the ringleader was, so he called him up and said, "We're about ready to reveal you guys and make a whole expose on Anonymous." Within 5 hours, all the H.B. Gary servers were brought down, and email was published in a huge backlash against H.B. Gary. And we'll explain how they did all this in less than 5 hours. We got an email from from Jim. Actually, Jim Russ sent me a couple of emails. He was interested in this. Jim said, I got an email from a friend this past week. The thing is, he's dead. Imagine the shock when I saw his name pop up in the spam folder in my Gmail account. Someone obviously has absconded with his email address for some nefarious purposes. I know it's a scam, so I deleted the email immediately and emptied the trash bin. Is there a place that I can report this to so that the spammer is caught and stopped? Well, actually, Jim, nobody hacked his email account. What happened is that his email address was probably in someone's directory, or an email that he had sent was probably sitting in someone's inbox. And that particular machine was compromised by one of these spam bots. And what the spam bot does, it goes in, it compromises the machine, and it sends out spam from that machine. And because you don't want to use the return address of the person actually sending the spam, what they typically do, they just glean email addresses from the contact list and the email in that account, and then they use those as a return address. So someone who corresponded with him was compromised, and so the email address was used improperly. This is why whenever you send out emails to a large group of people, say, you know, you've seen these lists go up maybe to 100 people or something, always put all those addresses as a BCC. So all those addresses are not exposed in the email, and they're less likely to be picked up by a spam bot. Great question, Jim. Now, Jim sent in a second question. He sent in a second question, actually. Let me see, where is this? Yes, he did. He said that, my phone is, what it is, I have a Sony Ericsson phone, a 760A cell phone on the AT&T network. I never turn it off. Now, last week I had trouble sending text messages because the phone told me that its memory is full. I only have one picture stored on the phone, no music, no ringtones. I cleared out all the sent and received messages. There was no change. So I turned the phone off and on, and that seemed to fix the problem. Is there some sort of cache in the cell phone that is cleared by turning off the cell phone and turning it on? Thanks, Jim. Well, Jim, your phone is suffering from memory leaks. Actually, so is my phone. I have a BlackBerry. And what a memory leak is, whenever there's an application running that uses memory and then it wants to release, application closes, it does not release the memory back to the operating system. That's called a memory leak. And normally, programs that aren't written properly don't release memory back to the operating system as they should. And over time, more and more of the memory is used, is actually unused and not released. For instance, my BlackBerry, I've got 128 megabytes available for application space, and I've loaded on a number of applications. And after I load on all the applications and turn on the cell phone fresh, it has about 16 megabytes of free storage. Within a week, that 16 megabytes of free storage is down to about 2 megabytes because of memory leak. And I just pull out the battery, reboot the machine, reboot the cell phone, and it comes back up to 16 megabytes. It's a typical problem. The fact that you could go so long without rebooting your cell phone means that you aren't running many applications, and those that you are running aren't leaking too much memory. But that was a great question, Jim. We got an email from Mrs. Bartiromo. Dear Dr. Schertz, I own a Sony Walkman that was purchased some time ago. It came with the following: AM/FM radio, cassette tape player, DC Metro TV stations, audio only. Now, the device works fine. I still love it, but now all the TV channels have moved to digital, so the TV part no longer works. Is there a newer device that can have all this that's in this mobile product that I can carry with me while riding a bike? Thanks for your thoughts, Mrs. Bartiromo. Well, you're in luck. Sony Walkman does their latest sports armband radio, which is what would perforate. It fits on your arm, and then you've got a headset. It comes with headphones, features a slim digital tuner that includes 30 presets. That would be 10 FMs, 5 AMs, 5 TV channels, and 5 weather bands. And everything is digital. It supports digital TV. In fact, all the new devices only support digital TV. But beware, beware. There are a lot of analog devices still out there, analog TV devices out there that are still on sale at a steep discount. So make certain that you get the digital choice. By the way, that Sony Walkman is only $65. We got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, I want to purchase a new PC and I'm considering a used ThinkPad. I found one posted on Craigslist and I'm wondering whether I should buy it or not. What's the best way for me to ensure that the machine is not a lemon when I get it home? What are the appropriate questions to ask the seller, who appears to be an individual and the original owner? Is there some test I can give before I buy the PC? Is it a reasonable thing to do? Well, Lauren, a few years ago, I would have recommended buying a used PC, but now the prices are so cheap. You can get laptops for, you know, a couple of $200 or $300. I mean, the prices have dropped lower and lower and lower. So I'm not sure that it really makes sense to get a used computer. I would recommend that you would get last year's model on sale, but get it new. Also, Dell will sell refurbished machines if you want to get ones that are about a year old. One of the problems with used laptops, you don't know how good the battery is, and a lot of times the battery is worn out. And if you have to replace the battery, it's fairly expensive. Now, if you really are dead set on this machine, you really ought to check to see what it has. So you can open it up, you can go to the control panel, and then go to systems, and it will tell you what the configuration is. It'll tell you. You can tell you how big the hard drive is, how much RAM it has. So you can see what the system configuration is. It'll tell you what operating system it has. Now, you've got to be careful about the software, because actually software costs exceed hardware costs. So if the machine comes without any software licenses and you've got to buy your own software and you can't get OEM pricing, you might find out that you don't save any money at all. So I probably would steer away from a used laptop unless I really knew the owner well, and I would just get a last year's model new. We got an email from Arnie. Arnie's one of our regular listeners here. Hi, Dr. Schertz. A couple of other questions if you have time on your Tech Talk program. What exactly is deep packet inspection, and how is it used? I understand it may be a way to reduce people from using so much bandwidth. How does it differ from normal users on the net? You also mentioned UMA and some other voice over IP phone systems during your last program. What kind of computer do you have in order to use UMA? I've got an old desktop, and I keep it on 24/7. Would that be okay? I have Verizon Fios broadband. And this last question, Lenovo was the subject of last Saturday's Tech Talk. It's interesting to note that Lenovo won a contract to provide computers to incoming freshmen at the Naval Academy. Cold War fighters would turn over in their graves knowing that one of Mao's people were selling PCs to the U.S. government. Then again, so much stuff is coming from China. And finally, boy, I tell you, Arnie had so many questions. Let's go back to the first one, and then I'll get to this last question at the end. Well, Arnie, let's go back to deep packet inspection. Deep packet inspection. Actually, that's used to identify what program is running the packets. You see, packets basically have what they call headers on them, and the header provides the first headers provide address information, so you can tell where it was sent from, where it's being sent to. Then if you go to the next header, it begins to tell you how the packets were divided up. And you go to the next header, it tells you what program was actually used to send the packet. And so if you go back in several headers deep, that would be deep packet inspection. You can tell what applications are running the program. And so, in particular, ISPs, Internet Service Providers, don't like people downloading all these MP3s with BitTorrent, because BitTorrent, you can actually be uploading and downloading literally hundreds of MP3s, and you can just saturate the bandwidth. And BitTorrent, unfettered, could actually eat up all the bandwidth of an ISP. So they have been using deep packet inspection to identify BitTorrent traffic and then limiting that. Now, Comcast was taken to court over that by the FCC, and then that ruling was reversed, and that gets back into the whole net neutrality deal. Now, deep packet inspection was also used by the Egyptians to track the kind of traffic going in and out of the country. They wanted to see who was doing what and how. And so deep packet inspections has also been used by governments to kind of snoop to see what's going on and what kind of data, what kind of applications people are using, what kind of things they're sending. And so there are there were a number of U.S. companies that were actually sent delivering deep packet inspection software to the Egyptians. I think all this gets back to net. And the final application of deep packet inspection are when they try to track your shopping habits on the web. They'll go into deep packet. They're able to track what you do with deep packet inspection. And some of these, there are techniques then that they can track what you buy, where you want to buy it, and that sort of thing. And there's people have been not very happy with the deep packet inspection applications there. But it was an interesting question. I think the whole net neutrality deal as it relates to limiting BitTorrent is probably going to ultimately come to a head when we resolve all of this net neutrality issues, and whether, and it's really now sort of tied up in a struggle between Congress and the FCC, because the FCC in the last go around sort of overstepped their bounds. Now let's talk about UMA. That was your second question. UMA, of course, is a voice over IP application. I have UMA at home. I've got also Verizon Fios. UMA is just a small box. It's an appliance. It's about a 8x8 box. It's about 2 inches deep. And you take this box and you plug it into your Fios router or into your broadband router. And then you take your phone system. I have a wireless phone system, so I have the base station. So I plug the base station of my wireless phone system into UMA. And what UMA does, it takes and converts the signal from my regular phone system into voice over IP packets and sends it out over the internet. Now, UMA, that particular box cost me around $225. I think I made a pay $200 on discount. So with that UMA, I pay $10 a month, a year. I pay $10 a year to UMA, and that gives me free phone calls over the entire United States. Then if I want to call, say, India, I can get Skype rates. I can get voice over IP rates. So I can call India with my UMA system for only like 2.5 cents a minute. Pakistan is about 10 cents a minute. China is about 2.5 cents a minute. And so I basically have a pre-charged account, and then I can call anywhere in the world, and I've got these nice voice over IP rates. And the beauty is I'm only paying $10 a year. Now you say, but what happened to your home phone number? Well, I transferred for $39 my old home phone number to my UMA account. So if people call my old phone number that I've had for 20 years, my phone rings just like it always rang. And so essentially I've gotten rid of my landline for $10 a month. And it has voicemail. It has, and whenever anybody leaves voicemail for me, it converts it to an MP3 and sends it to my email account. So no matter where I am in the world, I get my voicemails at the home phone. So it's a very nice system. UMA, you can go to UMA.com if you want to find out more about it. Now, Ernie had one question about this cybersecurity bill. He said, you know, do you have anything on this proposed legislation on cybersecurity? They call it the Internet Kill Switch. Actually, that's a bad name for it. Here's the thrust of the cybersecurity bill. They're trying to get at a way to protect our critical infrastructure. See, the problem is, power grids are connected to the internet. Financial systems are connected to the internet. Water supply systems, dams are connected to the internet. What happens if somebody is trying to attack infrastructure? Is there a way that a government can respond to that? Well, actually, the government's probably not the solution, and that the safeguard should be implemented through some standards task force. When you go back and look at the actual bill, what they did, the bill authorized one person, one entity, which is the director of National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. They're the ones that are all that run all the cybersecurity standards for the U.S. government. They're authorized to represent the government in negotiations with international standards committees and to coordinate all of the White House security activities with a cybersecurity university task force. I think that's probably the right idea. Governments are not in the middle of it, but they're basically defining the problem and trying to get the standards groups to work on it. I actually have to agree with that. Now, they also directed the National Science Foundation to engage in more research on social and behavioral aspects of cybersecurity, how people interact with their computers, how they manage their online identities. And I think that seems like a good, like something worthwhile too. On balance, I think it's a good bill. I think the Internet Kill Switch name is really the wrong name. Well, Arnie, thanks for those questions, and thanks for being a longtime listener. I think we'll take a break right now.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for Mr. Big
Voice.
There we go. Mr. Big Voice finally made it. You know, Mr. Big Voice has been having a problem. He was in the next room there, but we're going to have to discipline him a bit. Today we're going to talk about Tony Ma. Now, Tony Ma is the founder of Tencent Holdings, which controls China's largest instant messaging service with over 478 million users. He is regarded as one of China's most desirable bachelors. He was born on the island of Hainan in China, but he grew up in Shenzhen. Ma uses the nickname Pony because it's derived from the English translation of his family name, which is horse. So I guess when he was a little boy, he was a little horse, so they called him Pony. In 1993, he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Software Engineering from Shenzhen University. After graduation, Ma worked for the China Motion Telecom on internet paging systems. He was actually a software engineer, so he was doing programming for them. He worked there for a short while. Then he switched to Shenzhen Runshun Communications, and he worked on internet calling systems. I guess these would be voice over IP systems. In 1998, he quit. He quit the Runshun Communications, and he and five classmates started a company which they called Tencent. Now, what they did, since they knew how to program pagers now, they created a paging system which they would sell to local telecoms. Now, these guys, when they were in school, they liked to play the stock market, and they actually had earned, by playing the stock market, around $120,000 in profits, and they used that initial $120K to start the company. And so they started, you know, selling pager service to telecoms. They weren't making much money, but they were making a little bit of money. But it wasn't really going anywhere fast. Shortly after they started the company, around 1999, Pony Ma saw the program ICQ. Now, where that comes from is like, it's like a, it really comes, it's I, the letters ICQ, but it came from I Seek You. And it was really the first internet-based instant messaging system. It was actually developed by an Israeli company in 1996, ICQ. And I have to tell you, I was on ICQ, and I was talking to people. I mean, it was fascinating. I was talking to people on ICQ in Russia, all around the world. It was just absolutely fantastic. I really did enjoy it. That introduced me, actually, to instant messaging. I don't use it anymore, but in the beginning, back probably around 96, 97, I was using it, playing around with it quite a bit. Now, the thing with ICQ, it was used in the Western countries a lot, but it wasn't used in China because they didn't have a Chinese interface. They just had a Western language interface, so it wasn't popular in China. So in 1999, Ma and his team, they decided, why don't we adapt ICQ for the Chinese market and create one with a Chinese interface. So they called it Open ICQ for open source. So the OICQ. And he thought, you know, I'll set this thing up and then I'll sell it to the telecoms. And in addition to their pager service, they could have an instant messenger service. He couldn't get anybody to buy it. He got no offers. So they didn't really know what to do with it. So they offered it as a free download to the internet. And this thing took off like gangbusters. Within 9 months, 1 million people had downloaded OICQ, Open ICQ. And they were getting, you know, quite a bit of notoriety in China because it was the number one instant messenger in China. Well, it turned out that around 1997, ICQ had been purchased by AOL. And around the year, and they purchased it for around $400 million. They put some bucks on it. And around 2000, AOL began noticing OICQ in China, and they filed an intellectual property lawsuit against OICQ, saying that they were, you know, infringing on their trademark. They said OICQ is very close to ICQ. So, and actually it was. And actually it was all, the whole concept was copied from ICQ, so Tencent lost. So they went back and regrouped, and around December of 2000, they formally changed their name to QQ because OICQ had been, its nickname had been QQ. So they changed the name to QQ, and they were able to avoid any further lawsuits. They didn't have to change any of their code. Now, the problem is they had this great device. They had millions of users. And no revenue. No revenue at all. The OICQ business, now renamed QQ, was being supported by this meager paging business, which wasn't bringing in much in the way of money. So Ma was still going nowhere fast, but he had a popular product. He ought to be able to do something with it. So he went to the banks and tried to get a loan. They looked at his balance sheet, turned him down. Then he talked to other people about selling his company. They looked at his balance sheet. They looked at this QQ product that took a lot of server space and bandwidth and no revenue, and they weren't interested in buying the company. Finally, he got two VCs. He got a U.S. firm called IDC and a Hong Kong telecom to invest $2.2 million for a 40% share in the company. I mean, that was actually a pretty good investment for them ultimately. So he went ahead, then he had $2.2 million, and so that gave him a chance to sort of, you know, regroup and figure out a way to make money. Around the year 2000, the beeper business began to drop off. Remember, beepers were only, you know, used before cell phones were popular. As mobile phones began to take off in China, beepers began to fall out of disuse. I mean, you don't need a beeper if you've got a cell phone. And so their main revenue, of course, was beepers, and QQ wasn't making any money. So he wrote a program that would allow people using QQ to send a text message directly to a mobile phone. And, of course, you can do that now with all your instant messenger systems. You can send a text message out, and it'll go right to a mobile phone. Well, this was a new idea then. And what he did, he convinced the telecoms to share the revenue with him. So whenever they would make money on these messaging fees, he would get a little bit of it. Well, it turned out that messaging revenue from the telecoms contributed about 80% of the company's revenues because they weren't making that much. But at least they could keep the doors open, and they could pay for the bandwidth, because they were, I mean, with all of these users, they needed more server space, more bandwidth, and all of that cost money. And then Ma decided he better try to get more sources of revenue, so he added paid avatars, where if you wanted, when you were using QQ, if you'd want to have like a cute figure representing you, you could buy it, and then you'd have a nice avatar to represent you, and he made money on that. He also put some online gaming. He built that into QQ, and he finally began advertising. Now, by 2001... he began to make a profit. And get this, his registered number of users surpassed 500 million people. That's more people than are in the United States entirely. Now, there were 500 registered users, but maybe only 250 active users. And I'll explain why that was. You see, the QQ account became like a status symbol. And people would like to have an account that might be 88888. That's a very popular number. Or they might want a 66666. Or they'd want 686868. So what they tried to do, and the people would get a QQ account that was a particular lucky number sequence, and it had value. So they could sell it. They could, there was a black market for these special account numbers, and so there was a whole sort of black market of QQ accounts. Well, here's the problem. Somebody would register, and if they didn't get the number they'd want, they'd just register again. So somebody might register 10 or 12 times to get the number they would want. So you had a lot more registered users than you had active users. And for a while, he tried to charge for registration to stop this. Then everybody got mad at him. They started going to other instant messenger services. So he got rid of the paid registration, and he just decided to live with it. Now, QQ in 2003, they released their own portal, QQ.com, for online games. In 2004, Tencent issued an IPO in Hong Kong. Within a few months, the stock prices rose nearly 60% above the initial offering price, and Ma, at that point, was worth $190 million. So he started this company back in 98. They went public in 2004. So in 6 years, he created a personal net worth of around $190 million. That's why he's regarded as one of China's most desirable bachelors. In 2005, they launched PaiPai.com, which is a consumer-to-consumer platform, which is competing with Alibaba.com. This is a way to sell online or to actually have people outside of China buy something within China. It was a way to connect to the outside world. And Alibaba is very popular, and he wanted to compete with that. Ma was named the global business influential leader by Time magazine. But he still had a problem. Even though he was making money, everybody else was offering free instant messenger service. Like you could get a free instant messenger with Microsoft, and why are people going to so you really have to find more innovative ways to make money out of it. So he created one new paying service, which was an IM product solely for business in China called RTX. And so he could actually charge for that product because it was a way to actually market very targeted marketing of products within China. Tencent also added profits by licensing the QQ brand name to another Chinese company for products and toys, because QQ is really quite a popular name and a popular product within China. In 2010, Pony Ma was ranked by Forbes Rich List as number 249 in the world and the sixth richest person in China. I think so now you know everything you want to know about Tony Ma. We'll take a break, and coming back, we'll have our contest.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, five of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Now, it is time for our contest. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Pony Ma. And, of course, Pony is the founder of Tencent Holdings. I need to know what phone number do they call when they're coming in here? We're actually trying to rustle around here without Jim. And so we'll have to locate the phone number in a minute. Early in the show, I was talking about Pony Ma. He, of course, is the founder of Tencent Holdings, China's largest instant messenger service. They have over 500 million active users, 500 million registered users. Probably, the last time I checked, they had 350 million active users. It's more active users than we have people in the United States. So it's an interesting thing. But his name is an interesting name, Pony Ma. Where did he get the name Pony from? That'll be the question. If you get the right answer, where did he get the name Pony, you'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room. Now, because we're having a small problem with the phone system, we're not going to be able to get you on the air when you call in, but you can call in to the show, and we'll take a winner on the line, and then we'll announce who the winner is after the contest is over. You can call 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333 for that answer. Now, in the meantime, I want to talk about the trivia of the week. Now, computer geeks have broken the pi record. Now, this isn't the number of pis thrown. This, of course, is the ratio pi, which is the ratio between the diameter. Pi is the ratio between the diameter of a circle and or between the circumference of a circle and the diameter. And it's 3.16159. And two computer geeks have calculated the number pi to 5 trillion places. 5 trillion places on a single desktop in record time. Now, you see, pi is an irrational number, which means there's no repeating sequence. It just isn't. It's a completely non-repeating series of numbers. Now, that's more than 2.3 trillion digits more than the previous world record held by a Frenchman, Fabrice Billard. Now, the Japanese engineer Shigeru Kondo and an American student, Alexander Yi, achieved the result by using a program created by Yi and a desktop built by Kondo. The program took 90 days to compute the 5 trillion digits and over 60 hours to verify the result. Now, the computer built by Kondo had 96 gigabytes of RAM and over 39 terabytes of disk storage. Now, roughly 22 terabytes of disk would needed to perform the calculation. The algorithm used to calculate the digits of pi was developed by Yi. Now, he used Yi's algorithm. When they calculate pi, they use basically a series, and he used the Chudnovsky series, which is a very fast converging series to calculate this. If you want to find out all the details about this thing, you can go to Kundo and Lee Yi's website, www.numberworld.org, numberworld.org. And that'll be kind of an interesting story. These guys had a lot of fun doing that. Now, I don't think there's much real value in having pi taken out to that many places, but it is an interesting deal. Now, what I want to talk about now is the H.B. Gary story, how they were hacked. I talked about who they were and why they were hacked earlier as part of the mailbag. But now I'd like to go into the details of how the hackers actually got into their website in less than 5 hours. It's actually quite an interesting story, and there are a lot of lessons that can be revealed here. I'm not going to get too technical, but I want to skim through the highlights. Okay, it turned out that H.B. Gary Federal CEO is Aaron Barr. And Aaron Barr thought that he had identified the hackers of Anonymous. These are the people that were trying to bring down the those that they felt were against the WikiLeaks. And he was preparing to name those responsible for the group's actions, including those behind the distributed denial of service attacks against MasterCard and Visa and other WikiLeaks enemies. Then Barr told the person he believed to be the ringleader about his forthcoming expose, and the anonymous response was swift and humiliating. H.B. Gary's servers were broken into, its emails were pillaged and published to the world, its data destroyed, its website defaced. Now, let's just explain how they did it so quickly. And I'll tell you where we got this. There was a story in ArsTechnica.com. ArsTechnica.com. The author there actually interviewed the people from Anonymous, and they told them exactly how they did it. It turns out, A, they broke into the original database using what's called SQL injection. H.B. Gary's federal website was powered by a custom content management system called CMS. Now, unfortunately, this CMS was built by a third-party group, and it was fairly poorly written, and it was susceptible to the kind of attack that is made famous by, is called the kind of attack called SQL injection. Now, any content management system stores data in an SQL database. Now, you retrieve that data from the database with queries. Now, some queries are fixed. You know, you just ask for, give me everybody that lives in Richmond, Virginia. Now, other queries have parameters on them, and you pass the parameters to the database. Now, if the coding is faulty, the parameters basically are not screened for legitimate parameters, and it may be possible to inject parameters which are not valid parameters, but which will cause the database to execute queries that will allow the hacker to see records that he should not be able to see. So, you've got his dress. Okay, we just got the winner on the for the quiz, and it's Chris Gretchen from Ellicott City. And of course, the question was, where did the name Pony come from? And it turns out that his last name in China is Chinese, means horse. And so, when he was young, they just called him Pony. And so, congratulations, Chris! You win 2 tickets to fine dining. We'll get those tickets out to you next week. So what happened was, getting back to the H.B. Gary story, they actually used a command which, and the parameters they passed were the page navigation parameter and the page parameter, and they basically just put numbers in there that weren't proper numbers, and it crashed the system, and they could retrieve data from the database. Now, here's the data they grabbed. They grabbed the user database that had all the usernames, email addresses, and password hashes for authorized users. And so they had they didn't have the passwords themselves, but they had the password hashes. Now, what a password hash is, you take a password and you run it through a program that basically encrypts it. And if you store the encrypted result of that after you've run the password, it's called a hash. Now, in order to make it difficult for people to reverse engineer the hash, a number of good hash implementations use a couple of additional techniques. One is they do iterative hashing, where you actually run it through for the first time and encrypt it, and then you run it through a second time and encrypt it, and actually you encrypt it multiple times. So it's called iterative hashing. That makes it more difficult to reverse the process. The second thing that frequently is done is that you salt it, where you put a small amount of random data to the password before hashing it. And what that does, it means that you just can't simply do a simple lookup table. You've got to actually add random data to passwords that you're looking up, and that creates more options, and it's much more difficult to crack it. Now, those two techniques, neither of those techniques were actually used here, because that's what made it so easy. What hackers do when they go in to try to reverse things, they use what's called a rainbow table, where you go through and somebody puts in every password they can think of. These are generated by a computer program, and then it computes the hash. And then there's one particular encryption program called MD5, and there are a lot of rainbow tables out on that. So it turned out that the hackers had a rainbow table for eight digit passwords and up to 12 digit passwords, and there were two people in this entire hash database that had a very short password, actually just six letters and two numbers. And those two people happened to be Aaron Barr, the CEO, and Ted Vera, the chief operating officer. And those two passwords were so short that they could simply go to the rainbow table and they could search for the hash. They found it, and it gave them the password immediately. It was almost trivial to actually reverse engineer the hash. So they had the passwords for the CMS for both the COO and the CFO. Now, here's the problem. Neither Aaron nor Ted followed the best practices. They used that same password everywhere. They used it for their email. They used it for their Twitter. They used it for their LinkedIn account. So immediately, they had access to all of the email that these two gentlemen had because they had their passwords. They also used the same password to access servers. So Ted Vera had a password on a Linux machine. There was hbgary.com, and a lot of people had shell accounts on this machine, and it turned out that Ted's Vera password on the shell account was identical to the one he'd used in the CMS. They already cracked it. So immediately, the hackers had access to this hbgary.com machine. Now, on this, they got into this particular machine, and of course, his password that he had for that particular machine, he was not like a super user. He was just like a regular user. So they didn't have full access to everything on the machine because they didn't have access to the root. They had lower level access. So what they needed to do, they needed to use an exploit that would allow them to escalate their privileges to go to higher levels. And it turned out last October, there was an exploit for going to higher levels that was published. The patch should have been installed on the Linux server. It wasn't installed. The hackers simply used that exploit, and they were able to escalate their rights to root level using a vulnerability that had not been patched. Once they had full access to the hbgary system, they discovered megabytes of backup data, research data, which they purged from the system. Now, it gets even worse. Aaron Barr's password, he was administrator for the company's email accounts. So they had access to all of the company email because the same password was used there. So they went in and they located Greg Hoglund's mail account. They had access to it. They looked at all of his mail. Greg ran another server called rootkit.com. So they used that to get into his email account, and there were emails there that gave the passwords that he needed to get into the root to log in as at the root level for rootkit.com. So they were able to just work through the whole system. They had one problem that they needed to get remote access to rootkit.com. So they used Greg's email address to social engineer one of the guys at the back at the main company to actually give them remote access into rootkit.com. And so once they did that by remote access, they used that password and they were in. So here's a quick summary. They used a web application which had SQL injection flaws and insecure passwords. The passwords were badly chosen. The passwords were reused every place. Servers were allowed, and the servers were not patched. And there was a willingness of someone at the main company to hand over credentials via email. Now, here's the problem. H.B. Gary is a security company which is actually advising the National Security Agency. So this was a major black eye for H.B. Gary, and those are the lessons learned and how to avoid this kind of thing in your company. I think we'll take a break now, and then we'll be back to talk about the problem with the dancing pigs.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology, and we have the problem with the dancing pigs. There's kind of a security theme here. In computer security, the dancing pig problem, it's also known as the dancing bunny problem, is a statement on attitudes about some computer security by users. And it basically, it's sort of a derision of users by technical experts in security. And what they say is that given a choice between dancing pigs and security, the user will pick the dancing pigs every time. This was actually a remark made by Edward Felton and Gary McGraw in a security article. Now, if a web surfer clicks on a button that promises dancing pigs on his computer and instead gets a message describing the potential dangers of the applet, he's going to choose the dancing pigs over computer security almost every day. If a computer prompts him with a warning screen that says the dancing pigs could contain malicious code that might do permanent damage to your computer and could contain malicious code that might do permanent damage to your computer, he'll click OK without even reading it, and 30 seconds later he won't even remember what the warning said. So this is the dancing pig problem. One study of phishing. Now, phishing is where you send people to a fake banking site and you have them enter on all their information. I mean, this study on phishing showed that people actually do prefer dancing animals to security. A study showed the participants at a number of phishing sites, including one that copied the Bank of the West homepage, For many participants, the cute design and the level of detail and the fact that the site did not ask for too much information were very convincing factors to them. Two participants even mentioned the fact that this animated bear video that appeared on the page was very appealing. Some participants kept reloading the page just to see the animation again and again. So we have the problem that computer security, even when you're using the internet, really depends on whether the user is going to be mindful of it and he's going to choose security over the dancing pigs. Now, I've sort of brought that up today because this previous story about H.B. Gary Company, we had the security experts who had short passwords. They were only 8 characters, 6 letters and 2 numbers. They should have been longer and more secure. Secondly, they used the same password over and over and over again. It's almost like they were looking at the dancing pigs rather than the security. So I thought, if even the security experts are enticed by the dancing pigs, how can you criticize the actual user? So I thought that would be worth discussing that just a bit. Well, I'll tell you, we at Stratford, we actually have embed quite a bit in our computer program security and security issues. And what you actually end up doing when you go through there, you look at case studies of security and security issues and try to learn what the security best practices are. Now, the way we actually teach at the school, we try to embed critical thinking in all of the courses. Now, that means that the students are challenged with a problem and they have to think it through on their own. They have to look at the case study. They have to analyze it. They have to come up with the solution. Because when you learn in that fashion, by actually doing something, figuring something out, analyzing it on your own, led by the questions of an instructor, actually you remember it. That's as opposed to just memorizing something, which you might only remember for 2 or 3 months. So embedded with all of our programs is really a hands-on case study approach, and this particularly applies to security. We found that both in the software engineering, you want to embed security right into the system when you develop the software, and information systems, you want to put together systems that are secure. In networking and infrastructure design, you want to basically put together VPNs and firewalls and infrastructure that has the right hardware structure for security. And you also want to manage your passwords, train your users so that they operate properly. So it really is a very good field to be in, and I think this particular show highlighting some of the dangers when you don't follow best practices, you can see what would happen. Now, I'll tell you, we love your emails. We just love the emails, and you can reach the email. You can reach us by email at techtalk@stratford.edu. Now, and those emails will be sent directly to me. Now, we also would like you to go to the Facebook page. We need comments on the Facebook page. We got a lot of comments, but we'd like more comments. Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline. Leave a comment. We've got some discussion there for you. And you can also go to techtalkonline.com. And techtalkonline.com has got the podcast. Every Saturday, we take the MP3, we upload it to the web. We write the XML podcast. You can sign up for the podcast right at techtalkonline.com. You can also go to Apple iTunes and search for Tech Talk Radio Podcast, and you can download the podcast directly there. And what we particularly want you to do is go to the stratford.edu website and look at all the programs we have in business, in technology, in hospitality, in computers, and let them know that you heard about Stratford University on Tech Talk Radio. We'll see you next week.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests that are designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, firm that's located